Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
And welcome to Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. This is your co-host, Chris Driscoll. And along with me tonight are Bob Carson, our illustrious show founder, the always brilliant and affable Bob Carson, and Rainer Shea, the young Rainer Shea, the up-and-coming, the great young journalist, coming up on the left, coming up on the communist left, Rainer Shea. How are you doing, guys?
Oh, I'm glad to have gotten in here on this podcast just in time. I'm having a busy time with the beginning of the semester, but I'm glad to continue my writings and my appearances on this podcast.
Yeah. There you go. And Bob?
I'm doing well. I don't know if it was me. I was having a little difficulty hearing Rainer there, maybe just on my
me
end.
Me too.
But I am doing well.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, maybe Rainer can, I don't know, get the mic closer to his mouth or whatever. But, yeah, I was having a little bit of problem hearing you too, Rainer. But I think I got the gist of it. Here in Phoenix, we've got 52 degrees Fahrenheit and super windy. I'm sitting out on the back porch, as I always do, the back patio in front of the pool, but this is certainly not pool weather. You know, 52, a lot of people from the east and the north will be laughing at me even mentioning 52 degrees, but when that wind starts whipping up, 52 starts feeling like a lot cooler than it sounds. So, but anyway, hopefully I'll trudge through it, and otherwise I'll just retreat indoors. Tonight, of course, guys, is Iowa caucus night. We'll be mentioning that a little bit later. I was watching some of the caucus preliminary network coverage of the caucuses. I can tell you it was farcical. I mean, it really was. You know, given the polls, you know, showing Bernie Sanders as the way out front runner, the way they were covering the caucuses was at least the three that I watched. I watched MSNBC for a while, then I switched to CNN, and then I switched to CBS. And all three of those were, which, of course, they're all three liberal, you know, liberal, neoliberal, liberal networks that represent the billionaires who own those three networks. So I guess we got to expect that. But there's a really unbalanced coverage, I'll put it to you that way. And so I think people are going to – I personally, just having looked at the polls, I think people are going to come out being surprised if they're watching these big networks cover the caucuses. But in any case, this week's big news, of course, the caucuses, the first Democrat primaries, basically, of the season, and the impeachment trial, which has been getting 24/7 in-your-face coverage, and it's looking now like the Senate will elect to acquit on Wednesday. Now, I didn't put that up for a topic tonight, and I'd like to just wait a week and maybe talk about that next week, not so much this week. It hasn't happened yet, first of all, but give at least me a chance to digest what's gone on, talk about it afterwards rather than before. I don't know if you two want to mention anything about the impeachment trial. If you do, now's the time, or otherwise I'll launch into the first topic. Sounds like nothing. Okay.
No, I'm good, Chris, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sounds like nobody's got anything to mention there. And doesn't really surprise me. Sorry, Rainer, did you want to say something?
No, I was agreeing. I don't want to say anything about that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I mean, we all knew that this was really inconsequential. It was infighting between the two major factions of the capitalist ruling class, essentially. And, you know, it really is big news in a way, but we already knew what was going to happen. I kind of thought things would go different, as I mentioned several weeks ago, but it's really looking now like Trump will be acquitted, and we'll see how that comes down to the American public. The trial has certainly been, no one could possibly claim that the trial has been a fair trial on either side. I mean, the Democrats certainly not being fair, and the Republicans certainly not being fair. So anyway, we'll talk about that next week. But for tonight, I wanted to highlight this first story. It comes from an article from Whitney Webb from Mint Press News. And, of course, I've mentioned Whitney quite often. I just think she's a brilliant reporter, a brilliant journalist. And the article I'm speaking of appeared in mintpressnews.com this week. And it's titled, How Government and Media Are Prepping Americans for a Failed 2020 Election. Now, this, in my opinion, this is a really an important article for people to look for. Go to mintpressnews.com and look for Whitney Webb, January 28th, 2020, How Government and Media Are Prepping America for a Failed 2020 Election. Now, essentially, this article, what it's talking about is the fact that government agencies, especially espionage agencies, and the mass media, the billionaire-owned mass media that I was just talking about, have for several weeks now, really for several months, been preparing Americans for an idea which is really based on fake news that the 2020 elections will be massively meddled in and interfered with and basically made fucked up, if you allow me to say, by three countries, Russia, China, and Iran. Now, these claims are being made by these news sources and by these espionage agencies, American espionage agencies, with absolutely no evidence. There's absolutely no evidence that Russia, China, or Iran are interfering with American elections in the 2020 or in 2016, for that matter, or that they intend to. And yet, we are being blasted by this fake news over and over again. To me, it's just amazing the headlines that these people are putting out. These headlines are just like, I mean, just astounding headlines claiming that Russia, China, or Iran, or all three, or one or two of them, or whatever, are interfering with American elections. Headlines such as "Hackers are coming for 2020 elections, and we are not ready." Another one: basically, every U.S. national security leader is warning about foreign interference in the 2020 election, and U.S. intel agencies, Russia, China plotting to interfere in 2020 election. Many others, but that's the kind of fake news that these people are putting out. They're obviously attempting to sow mass hysteria. Ultimately, some of these espionage leaders, if you want to call them that, spooks, I call them, spooks, Some of them are claiming that that it will get so bad because we are not prepared that elections will have to be called off. And, you know, will cause major civil unrest, which obviously it would. It's just amazing to me that these agencies, these spook agencies, are putting out this garbage, these lies. And they're obviously doing it quite intentionally with the goal of preparing the American public for something. And, I mean, you know, they've even given a foreshadowing, a hint of what they're really looking forward to. We don't really know if the president of the United States, Donald Trump, would actually call off the elections, the first time that was ever done in American history, if that was ever done. And, of course, would have to be something that the president of the United States did in as part of a national emergency. But it's obvious that they are preparing people for something that's not even coming. But they, you know, it didn't come in 2016, and yet they have been talking ad nauseum about it since then. I really have to thank Whitney Webb for her reportage. I advise people to look look at this article and you know, take a look at it and consider all the evidence that Whitney has arrayed, the evidence of this conspiracy of fake news that is obviously intended to sow chaos in the United States and to sow chaos that the espionage agencies will then be able to take advantage of in some way or another. And the most likely way would be an even further trampling of our political rights, of our civil rights, even further trampling of our basic free speech. That's, to me, that's obviously what these people are after. So, Bob Rayner, any thoughts on this article?
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to read the article, but I read a lot of the stuff, though, that you sent over that we're going to talk about later on today. But I got to tell you, you know, we've heard this before, obviously, and what this looks like to me, you know, just on the surface of things, is this looks like the media is laying the groundwork, you know, to minimize a Trump victory in the upcoming presidential election. You know, they want to they could see the writing on the wall here, and they want to try to minimize it, I think, and try to, you know, taint a Trump presidential victory, and, you know, essentially declare him as illegitimate, as they did, you know, as they tried to do in the 2016 election with the Russia gate nonsense, where there wasn't a shred of evidence of collusion between him and Putin, and never was, and all these subsequent inquiries and investigations, and it was a complete hoax, and here we go again, and so that's what it looks like to me. It's manufactured propaganda. And it's one more reason why I think the American people distrust the media, the American people do not have faith in the media. The opinion polls reflect this, and, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, among the major media, every one of them except for Fox is on the liberal, neoliberal side of American, of the American, the narrow, narrow American political spectrum, and they reflect the fact that the great majority of billionaires and the great majority of the most powerful ruling class figures are liberals. You know, it reflects a real fact of life in America. So, Bob, that's a good point. Rainer, any thoughts?
This is the culmination of the trends that we've been seeing for the last several years. I've been following this whole narrative that the American media and also generally imperialist media like The Guardian have been spinning since the 2016 election, that creates mass hysteria about Russia interfering with democracy, and it's just been a whole alarming trend of propaganda and censorship and McCarthyism. It's been used to attack politicians, not just Trump, but also Jill Stein and Julian Assange, of course, and Tulsi Gabbard and Bernie Sanders. So it's a political weapon that that what you would call the globalist side of the American ruling class is using to attack its enemies, ranging from Trump to the left. And now we're seeing their strategy for 2020, which is to stir up anxiety about foreign interference right from the start. I wonder where
absolutely
it's going to lead.
Yes. You know, another side of this is that it's pretty obvious that the capitalist ruling class is really shaking in its boots about the commercial, the industrial competition that they face from China, and the superior military might that they face from Russia, and, you know, to a lesser extent, even from Iran, if some reports can be believed, Iranian cyber technology, Iranian technology, electronic warfare technology aimed at American weapons systems, aimed basically at turning off American weapons systems before they can be deployed. You know, it's pretty obvious to me that the capitalist ruling class really wants to shake American people up, to spread fear among American people about these three countries. And why is it? You know, two of them are capitalist countries, Iran and Russia. One of them is a socialist country, China. But the crucial thing here is that all three of those countries, they are the global leaders of the anti-imperialist movement, of the global anti-imperialist movement. That's what it comes down to. These are three countries that stand up to American imperialism, to American bullying, to the evil American empire. So get ready, folks, and watch out, beware. Do not believe the fake news. Do not believe the American propaganda. This is what we see prior to every war that America has ever engineered, ever executed. We always see this demonization. We always see these great lies. You know, they're based primarily on lies. We've seen it before. Anyone as old as I am has seen it many, many times. Get ready for it. So those are my thoughts on the matter. Topic number two, the farce of a peace plan. President Trump, along with his fascistic buddy, Benny Netanyahu, who, not coincidentally, by the way, was also indicted on charges of corruption, misuse of power, and so forth, in the Zionist state last week. But anyway, Benny Netanyahu and Trump got together and presented their peace plan for the Zionists and the Palestinians. Now, this peace plan, all you have to do, tell you the truth, all you have to do is take a look at the map that would result to see that this peace plan is really a plan. It's a Bantustan plan. Those of us who are old enough to remember apartheid South Africa will remember that there were Bantustans, tribes in South Africa, who were basically herded onto reservations as a way to control them. And that's basically what this plan is all about. Now, according to the United Nations, there's already a peace plan. It was signed in the 80s, late 70s, I think, that gives the Palestinian people basically all of the land that was stolen from them after the 1968 Palestine-Israel War. And that two-state plan, was certainly not fair because a lot more land than that had been stolen. But if you look at the map, the pre-1968 map of Greater Palestine, and you look at the map as it would result from this Trump peace plan, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's just a bunch of little disconnected splotches, a few dozen around Palestine, and the rest giving the rest of it to the fascist Zionists. It's an absurd plan. Apparently, it was crafted by Trump's idiot son-in-law, Kirchner, who's always been a vile, virulent Zionist, a fascist Zionist himself. So no surprise there. Anyway, this peace plan has been roundly condemned by countries around the world. It's really looking like a way to forge forward with the real Zionist plan, which is a one-state Zionist fascist state covering all of Greater Palestine. Now, I have personally never been a proponent of the so-called two-state solution. I've always thought it was unworkable, first of all, and unfair. I have always been an advocate of a democratic, secular Palestine in which people of all religions, people of all nationalities, all the nationalities who live in that land could peacefully live together under real democratic and socialist Palestine. That's ultimately, to me, the only workable plan, but it may take a long, long time to get there. Anyway, what do you guys think? Trump's peace plan, Middle East peace plan.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. As you mentioned, Kushner was very, very good friends with Netanyahu. Netanyahu has never been interested in any type of amicable solution to this crisis. This is occupied territory. This is acquired territory by force, which violates international law. It's occupied territory. Mahmoud Abbas did not even attend this meeting, which really, you know, says a lot. Christopher, as you pointed out, most countries rejected this. Trump's plan would give the Palestinians supposedly 75% of their own land. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. But the problem is that Netanyahu and the far right never want any type of solution. Hamas and the Palestinian leadership has been democratically elected since, I believe, 2004, and still that wing of the Israeli government does not want to deal with Hamas. You mentioned there was a peace agreement. Itzhak Rabin, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, who was assassinated, was in part, you know, responsible for bringing that to fruition and whatnot. There's never going to be peace. There's never going to be any type of a solution as long as the players that are in charge are currently in charge.
Right. Rainer, you want to add anything?
Oh, well, this is certainly no surprise. It
no.
reflects the goal that Zionists have been carrying out in that region for generations, and their ultimate goal is to erase Palestine. There's a popular and very ominous arguing point that I've seen Zionists use, and it's that Palestine doesn't really exist. That we shouldn't take it seriously because these are people who apparently don't even have a real national identity, and the only people Israel is fighting are dangerous terrorists who want to destroy the Jews. This is the solution that they're trying to work out is an extension of Israel's broader efforts to turn Gaza into one big concentration camp. Marginalize and relegate the Palestinian people to a status of second-class citizen, and to make them into a people of refugees and peasants who are struggling to survive amid a war with a power that. A superior army to them. It's genocide, and the only way that it will be it will end is a successful extinction effort of the Palestinians. They won't all be killed, but it could result in something resembling the Native American genocide. Where pretty much the whole Native American population was wiped out to make way for the fascist settler colonial state that's now called the United States of America. But hopefully, if the world everything will be decolonized.
Yeah. Okay, topic number three, the real Ukraine scandal is not acknowledged by Congress nor by the news media. There's a great article on the subject by Joe Loria in the Consortium News, from September 26, 2019. But I think the Consortium people... Consortium News people reposted it, and it's really worth reposting right now because this article basically it proves the fact that while Trump is pretty obviously guilty in this so-called Ukraine scandal. And the reason that he's was impeached and is on trial in the Senate right now, to see whether he's guilty or not of these charges. The fact is that this is the way American so-called foreign policy, I call it imperial policy. This is the way American imperial policy has worked for generations, at least since World War II, and really a lot longer than that. That is by using bribery, by using blackmail and other techniques to get what they want around the world. Loria brings up the fact that this same method of threatening to withhold aid and of threatening to punish countries in other ways if they don't go along with American imperialist policy, it's done in almost all American imperial policy. For example, in the last two major wars, the Gulf War in the early 90s under the first President Bush, President George Herbert Walker Bush, and in the lead up by the younger Bush, the George W. Bush in 2003 in the invasion of Iraq. In both cases, they used this method against countries in the United Nations to force support in the United Nations out of it. Loria points out that we know from a leaked telephone call in early 2014 in a conversation between Victoria Nuland, then Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, and Jeffrey Pyatt, then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine. We know that Vice President Biden, the Vice President at that time, played a role in midwifing the U.S. backed overthrow of the elected Ukrainian government soon after that election. That same telephone call, they described who would be in the post-coup government. And, of course, most of the people in the post-coup government came from openly, unabashedly fascist and or Nazi political parties. So there was Obama using his military might to force a fascist Nazi government on the people of Ukraine, which started a major civil war in Ukraine that rages on today between the primarily Russian-speaking eastern portion of that country and the primarily fascist western part of that country. We've seen this over and over again. Biden, of course, as a result of that overthrow of a legally elected Ukrainian government, was able to get his own son a job at Ukraine's biggest gas producer, Burisma Holdings, and that when the national Ukrainian prosecutor, the head prosecutor of the country, started an investigation of Burisma Holdings, Biden threatened to withhold U.S. Military aid of about a little bit more than $1 billion worth from Ukraine until that prosecutor was arrested. Fired. And of course, afterwards, we know that the Biden on a videotape before before a major ruling class, basically, audience, Biden boasted about how he got the guy fired by withholding aid to Ukraine, which is exactly the same crime that Trump is accused of in the current Senate hearing. So this is par for the course for Imperial America. This is the way business has always been done for decades and decades and decades in the United States. There is nothing abnormal about it. There's nothing abnormal about what Trump did. It's the same thing that that Obama and his vice president, Biden, did. It's the same thing that presidents for decades in the past have done. So, interesting article, and shows the shows the real hypocrisy of the American empire.
And let's not also forget that Secretary of State John Kerry also got a seat on the board of Burisma after this occurred too. So is an absolute disgrace.
His stepson. Kerry's stepson.
Okay. I thought I read it was Kerry, but okay, you might be right, yeah.
Yeah. Now Kerry's not gonna take a dipshit little thing for, you know, $70,000 or $80,000 a month. Kerry's making millions and millions of dollars, you know, going out and giving speeches and shit. He doesn't have to take crumbs like that. That's for the underlings. That's for, like, his stepson and people like that. Or, you know, Biden's son, you know, that kind of job. So, anyway, Rainer, anything else?
Oh, you've certainly been following this Biden-Ukraine scandal more than I have, and I see that as about as predictable as the corruption that Trump has engaged in. The thing about the coverage of this Ukraine issue, though, that I've seen in the media is that the media has been decrying Trump for withholding military aid to Ukraine. And was this in connection to the incident that happened in late 2017 when Trump, I recall, was pressured by Russiagate into sending military aid to Ukraine? It seems like the media is decrying Trump for not giving military aid to this fascist anti-Russian government that's stoking tensions. And I recall that even Obama thought it would be too reckless to give that aid to Ukraine, but the anti-Russia neocons escalated the situation, and now it seems like the neocons are mad at Trump for not quite following through.
Right. Yes. In any case, topic number four, rigged Democrat primaries and Sanders. Now, I've already mentioned some of this, how Sanders, the coverage of Sanders has basically been unfair. Now, I don't really give a fuck about that because Sanders is a phony himself and doesn't deserve any better. But it really shows, you know, anybody, even a phony socialist who's claiming to be a socialist is not going to get anywhere, is not going to get the Democrat Party nomination in these rigged Democrat primaries. Now, there's a really great article, although I didn't agree with all of it, on February 2, the very second, yesterday I guess it was, The Party's Over, Bernie's Last Dance with the Dems. This article is by Jim Cavanaugh. And basically it goes over the good, the bad, and the ugly. Kind of like that old Clint Eastwood Western, spaghetti Western. But the good, the bad, and the ugly of Sanders. Now, some of what he says in The Good about Sanders is basically a lie. Like, for instance, claiming that Sanders is an anti-war candidate, which is just a total bullshit when you look at Sanders' real record of voting for billions and billions of dollars. What is it now? More than three quarters of a trillion dollars for military spending. When you look at his record of voting for wars, Sanders is no anti-war candidate. However, then he goes over, the good, the bad, and then the bad. You know, he talks basically about how far the Democrats are willing to rig these primaries to ensure that Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination. And then he talks about the ugly, which, basically he's, I think, kind of admitting that Sanders' chances of getting the I think the way he puts it is that Sanders, the chance of getting the nomination from the Democrat Party are, they are about 15%. Now, I don't think it's even 15% because I think that the capitalist ruling class, which owns and controls the Democrat Party, is going to ensure that Sanders, even as tepid a social democrat as Sanders, cannot and will never get the Democrat nomination for president. So the kind of, I think the Greenville Post put this article up basically to start a conversation, to start a debate. So, wondering if we can have a little bit of a debate here over this issue and over the whole the nature of the Democrat Party and why people should never, ever consider voting for it, much less, running for their nomination like Sanders does, but should never consider lending any support to this capitalist class political party. So,
yeah,
Bob, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you. I mean, you made a lot of good points there because I disagree with Kavanaugh on a lot of different things here. You know, he goes on to argue that some of these Democratic candidates are fizzling out, like Elizabeth Warren, you know, for example, when she accused Bernie of lying, and Bernie is surging. Bernie has a fan base, and you know, Bernie has people raising money and whatnot, but. The problem is as you said, is that the Democratic National Committee will never allow Bernie to win. The Democratic donor base will never allow Bernie to win. We saw this in 2016 with the primary rigging, with the voter suppression, with all of the different tools that they had to give Hillary the nomination. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, after that, after it was proven that this happened, you would think that he would no longer caucus with the Democratic Party. You would think that he would disassociate himself with the Democratic Party. But Bernie Sanders, as one thing I do agree with Kavanaugh, it hasn't changed. He hasn't changed at all. So, you know, he's going to continue to align himself with the Democratic Party and basically be a sheepdog for the Democratic Party to try to draw younger voters out there and create the appearance that the Democratic Party is, you know, somehow standing up for the little guy out there, when in actuality that's not the case. Just a few things here that, you know, on the surface could appear that it's boding well for Sanders. Joe Rogan came out. Joe Rogan is a very influential podcaster, came out and endorsed Bernie Sanders recently. Some people think that's going to make a difference. You've got several people that dropped out of the Democratic race, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and Beto O'Rourke, and this guy Buttigieg, whatever his name is, he's a flake that everybody agrees on. And Biden is just a disaster of a candidate. However, the Washington establishment, the DNC, the voter base, or the donor base, likes Joe Biden despite his his problems with voters and the truth and this Ukraine scandal, which the media is ignoring. He's going to be the guy. There's no question about that. And so, Sanders is irrelevant, and he's always been irrelevant. And this election season is going to be no different whatsoever. It's not the voters that control anything. And you're right, Christopher. No voter, particularly minority voter, or working class voter, should support the Democratic Party for a multitude of reasons.
When I was a Bernie supporter all those years ago, I was being shocked by the scale of the attack on democracy that I was witness. I follow closely how seemingly millions of votes were taken away from Sanders through tactics like hacking the vote count to flip the count through statistically impossible discrepancies, tactics like depriving likely Sanders voters of access to the polls, purging the voter rolls, and of course the WikiLeaks revelations. Steals how many people viewed that primary, and I've since become much better educated about the nature of what I had witnessed. What I had witnessed was an example of bourgeois democracy. There's a Lenin quote about how democracy under capitalist-controlled government is curtailed, restricted, taken away from the majority, and made so that only the most privileged can really have any real power. And this time around, I'm educated. I have a platform, and I'm going to closely observe this primary and work to expose whatever cheating happens throughout the next few months. I may not like Sanders anymore, but I feel like I owe it to his supporters to try to expose the cheating that they're going to be subjected to, because if we keep exposing this fraudulence of bourgeois democracy, then a lot more people are going to wake up like us and leave the Democratic Party for good, and join a movement to a proletarian democracy, where the bourgeoisie can no longer pull the strings like it does now.
Well, I applaud you for speaking out so honestly about Bernie Sanders and sort of coming off of that the Bernie Sanders support train. I think it takes a lot of courage for you to do that and educate younger folks like yourself, not to fall into the trap, the Democratic Party trap, and the Bernie sheepdog trap. So, man, I take my hat off to you.
Me too, Bob. In fact, both you and Rayner, you've gone through the same kind of political journey here with the Democrat Party, you know,
yes,
over the last 10 years or so, coming to the same conclusions. You know, hopefully if you've gone through this journey, others will. And the fact that Sanders is doing the same stupid thing that he did last time, that is participating in these Democrat primaries. Although, you know, the fact that Sanders is not and has never been a member of the Democrat Party, to me, that alone is kind of astounding, because could you imagine any Communist Party allowing somebody from outside their party to run for the nomination of any post in that party? It just would not happen. We would not allow, you know, an outsider, a person who is not doing anything for the party, why should they be allowed to vote, you know, I mean, to run for a nomination in the party in the first place? But in any case, that's what Sanders has done twice now, and with the same results. It's like that old saying from Einstein, you know, doing the same thing over and over and again and expecting different results. The results are not going to be different.
Why do you think he does this? Is it just to get his name out there? It would be more difficult for him otherwise. I don't understand. Is it just he doesn't have a spine? What is it?
Well, you know, he's fooled himself. I mean, 40 years ago, Sanders was a delegate for the Socialist Workers' Party in the 1976 election season. He was a delegate in New Hampshire for the Socialist Workers' Party, in other words, representing Peter Camejo. If people who remember Camejo, unfortunately died a few years back, but he was Ralph Nader's vice presidential running mate in 2004. Is a stupendous guy. I mean, Peter himself was he ran for president on the Socialist Workers' Party ticket, and then he ran for vice president on the Green ticket with Ralph. and independent tickets. But that shows how far this one man has come from being a man who supported a communist for president, to a man who, has become a tepid social democrat. I mean, in a lot of social democratic parties, Sanders would be considered on the far right wing of the party, So he's, even calling him a social democrat is a stretch. But I think that Sanders has fooled himself because he has been able to win first as a mayor, then as a House of Representatives member, and then as a Senate member. He's been able to win elections running as an independent, running as an avowed socialist over the last 30 to 40 years, and because Sanders really is looking good in the polls. Even running up against the former vice president of the United States, Sanders is looking pretty damn good in these early caucus and primary states. I mean, Sanders is going to win Vermont. New
Iowa?
Hampshire. Not Iowa, the other one next to Vermont. New Hampshire. Yeah, he's got to win the New Hampshire primary, which is the next primary, by an extraordinary amount. They're predicting right now 60, almost 70%. So he's going to win that one, which isn't that much of a surprise because it's his neighboring state.
Right.
And they know him pretty well up there. But all the polls leading up to Iowa have also said that he will win Iowa. I mean, I don't know how that's going to go. These caucuses are kind of weird because you have these people, going back and forth between different caucuses, and they're coming over and haranguing each other and cajoling each other. You never know how these caucuses are going to go. People can, make switches at the last moment. There are a whole fuckload of people who are supporting, candidates who are not going to win. And so in second and third rounds, they're going to have to choose candidates that they didn't come in supporting at first. I'm not making any predictions about what will happen in Iowa. I was, by the way, Bob, you probably remember I was living in Iowa in 2016 when we were talking about this back in 2016.
Yeah.
So, I went through it all. The Iowa caucuses are a little bit weird. I mean, it's very possible. I was watching the coverage before we started the show, and they were going to. I think that the caucuses that they chose to cover in all three cases and all three networks were definitely on the conservative side. You could tell from where they were showing these caucuses. They were in a lot of them rural areas that were pretty conservative. So it was hard to see what was going on. But, Sanders had a pretty big crowd in his favor in the cases that I saw despite that. So we'll see,
Chris, What about the Democratic National Convention, the delegates? I mean, you probably follow that a lot more. I mean, there could be a lot of trickery with the awarding the delegates, with who awards who the delegates. So that's a whole other ball game, right?
Right. Well, and first of all, there's the superdelegates,
Right.
Even if Sanders wins all these, wins the enough primaries to get the nomination, he still won't get the nomination because of the superdelegates. It's just ridiculous to even contemplate it. Esteem for Sanders has gone way, way down. Starting in 19, 99 when he supported Clinton bombing the hell out of Yugoslavia. You know, to me, a socialist country, Yugoslavia, a successful socialist country with a successful socialist model, run by a communist party, and this fuckhead pretend socialist supports bombing the fuck out of Yugoslavia and the disassembly, you know, the destruction of Yugoslavia. To me, right then, that's when I stopped supporting. I liked him before that. You know, I was in the Labor Party back when it was begun, and Sanders was a big supporter of the Labor Party, although he had a lot of big fights with Tony Mazzocchi, the leader of the Labor Party back then. He was pissed off because Tony wouldn't support him running him for president in 96. They had a big knockdown dragout fight over that. Tony regaled me with the story afterwards. But Sanders has just gone way downhill in my opinion. And he's not even you can't even call him a social democrat anymore. He's really an FDR capitalist, you know. I mean, he's a welfare capitalist. Anyway, the good thing about this is that a lot of young people who consider themselves socialists are going to be disillusioned by this form of tepid social democracy, and they may start looking to revolutionary socialism as an alternative. And that's what we've got to hope for. That's what happened in the Russian Revolution. At the start of the Russian Revolution, the overwhelming majority of workers were social democrats and populists. By the time, you know, it was over, most of them were communists and members of the Bolshevik Party. So things can change real quick. And in this kind of thing, you know, a lot of people are going to learn the lessons that Rayner was just explaining that he went through. A lot of people are going to learn those lessons, and we've got to be ready to be talking to those people about why revolutionary socialism, why communism is so much more effective for the working class than social democracy is. So, any other comments, guys? Okay, we're more than halfway through the show, and we're only on topic four. So, topic five, though, is really important. The Embassy Protectors trial starts on February 11th. They've been going through some preliminary pretrial hearings prior to that. One of the hearings was about what can be expressed. Now, we've talked about the Embassy Protectors in the past, especially when this thing was going on. For hundreds of people in the D.C. area came to defend the Venezuelan embassy, four of whom actually stayed in the embassy after all the rest had moved on and gone outside. But these four remained, and they were there at the invitation of the Venezuelan government to protect its embassy because diplomatic relations between the United States and Venezuela had broken down. The United States was asked to remove all its personnel from the American embassy in Caracas. The same thing here in Washington, D.C., Venezuelan ambassadors were asked to get out in a hurry. Venezuela has obeyed the law. They have honored the U.S. embassy, not invaded the U.S. embassy, but the United States has broken the law, violated the law, violated the international law concerning embassies by allowing its fake self-appointed president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, to pretend that he has the right to assign a new ambassador to the United States, which is absurd, ridiculous, and utterly breaking the law, you know, utter violation of international law. So these four people stayed in the embassy to the last, and they were, I mean, to the point where they were, they had their water and electricity turned off by the Americans. They were attacked. I mean, they were being attacked by gangs of right-wing Venezuelans and other right-wingers. And these four intrepid people, they stuck around till the end. Hold on, let me get, get here. Here we go. The four that we're talking about, and they stayed in that embassy defending it at the invitation of the Venezuelan government for 37 days. They were pediatrician Margaret Flowers, medical anthropologist Adrian Pine, attorney Kevin Zeiss, and activist David Paul, and they are now on trial for trespassing, no less, even though they were invited to be there by the Venezuelan government. They are the police broke in, the D.C. police broke into this embassy, arrested these four, and charged them with trespassing. I actually worked with Kevin Zeiss, one of the four, for like 10 years, very closely. So I know Kevin pretty well. Margaret, who's Margaret Flowers, pediatrician, who's Kevin's companion or whatever you call it these days. Girlfriend is what I used to call it, but is, I think companion is the word now. Then Adrian Pine and David Paul. These people got enormous support. Even Reverend Jesse Jackson came to give a food delivery to the embassy protectors. Now, the amazing thing about this, the judge in the case, Judge Beryl Howell, who's a vile woman, I mean, it's the only way you could put it, she has already gone through these hearings where she has told these four defendants that they can only say three things. Their lawyers can only say three things in the trial. They can only deal with three things. That is that the four were in the embassy, that they were given notice of eviction by the police, and that they refused to leave. Those three items. Now, the fact is, and of course, here's the funny thing about Judge Howell. Judge Howell is obviously prejudiced. She, before she became a judge, she was the head architect of the Patriot Act. So that shows you what kind of a vile human being she is. She's referred to the embassy protectors as a gang, quote unquote. But here are the things that she is not allowing them to bring up in the trial: that Nicolas Maduro is democratically elected president of Venezuela, that Juan Guaido has no legitimacy and does not represent the Venezuelan government, does not represent anybody anymore, that Carlos Vecchio, Juan Guaido's appointed ambassador, also has absolutely no standing in demanding that the embassy protectors leave the embassy, although he did, that they were in the embassy with the permission of the elected government of Venezuela, that they received advice that they were in the embassy legally, that negotiations were ongoing between the U.S. and Venezuela for a mutual protecting power agreement, which would have resulted in Switzerland protecting the U.S. embassy in Caracas and Turkey protecting the Venezuelan embassy in D.C., that they were surrounded by a coup mob, that electricity and water was turned off, that the Vienna Convention, which is the international law for this kind of, for embassies and for ambassadors, was violated by federal agents who had no legitimate right to enter the embassy to arrest them, and that the embassy protectors were acting within their First Amendment rights. All of those facts have already been denied by Judge Howell to be and talked about or discussed or brought up in the trial. So people sitting in judgment of the case will not be able to hear any of this stuff. The jury will be – it's like the jury's got blinders and earplugs, you know. So really a shame. It's something that all of us should be helping to protect these people. Go to the Greenville Post, January 31st, Embassy Protectors, an epic act of resistance and trial of our times. Look it up. It's by Lauren Smith, who this first appeared in the Black Agenda Report. So I guess you could get it either on Greenville Post or on the Black Agenda Report. You know, Google it, look it up, read the article. Give these people all your support because they really, really should get your support. So, Rainer, any thoughts?
Oh, this definitely reminds me of what happened with the Venezuelan embassy May of last year when the Veterans for Peace president was violently arrested with the complicity of the Trump White House and the Secret Service for trying to help the embassy protectors. You mentioned the judge who was the same person who helped write the USA Patriot Act, the 2001 law that massively expanded the powers of America's surveillance state and drove America towards fascism post 9/11, but we're seeing how this is how American imperialism is turning inward during its process of outward decline. You know, despite all of this, despite the aggressiveness of the Trump administration in trying to force its will onto Venezuela, and despite the aggressiveness of America's national security state in crushing the most direct dissent of the Venezuela regime change attempts, the United States has lost in Venezuela, but Guaido isn't going to become president. He's just this figure who Washington continues to try to hold up, but he's not going to get that power.
Yeah, that guy that you were talking about is Jerry Condon. He's the president of Veterans for Peace, longtime president of Veterans for Peace. I mean, I remember I had a roommate who worked for them. And he was the president at that time, so that was like 10, 12 years ago. So he's been around a long time. He's a 72-year-old man. He was brutally attacked by the pigs and arrested. Person who wrote the article, Lauren Smith, I think her name was mentioning how you noticed the Jesse Jackson was not attacked by the police, but Jerry Condon, 72 years old, was brutally attacked, brutally during that whole thing. So both of those were, supporters of this embassy defense. great people, you know, especially Condon. So anyway, last topic tonight, guys, Davos. Of course, the Davos conference was a couple of weeks ago. There's a great article that I think was well worth mentioning. The Davos conference, basically, let me see here. Let me get it. The article that I'm referring to was by Vija Prashad on January 31st in consortiumnews.com. So look it up there. But the article is titled, I Will Hold You in My Arms a Day After the War. Vija Prashad reflects on the neoliberal orthodoxy, the latest meeting of the tired decision makers in Davos, and a hybrid war in Latin America that is creating the conditions for chaos. And, you know, that's the basically Prashad was in this article making the contrast between these billionaires in high-up capitalist politicians and business personalities meeting in Davos. And it was as though they were living on another planet, you know, in another world of their own making. The way they talked, what they talked about, you know, they talked about environmental crisis as though it was something brand new that they had just discovered, he says. That's a pretty good point. But, you know, the main thing, these same people, especially through the American empire, which is their main instrument of oppression, are deliberately using financial instruments and military instruments and espionage instruments to spread chaos throughout Latin America. We're seeing this more and more in like the failed coup in Venezuela last year, in the successful coup against a socialist government my brain is getting tired tonight, guys. Help me out. The coup, the successful coup engineered by the United States in not Brazil, Bolivia, I'm sorry, in Bolivia, against Evo Morales, and several other, you know, examples that we can see of just basically of chaos being spread throughout Latin America deliberately by these same Davos, you know, attendees, for the purpose of, you know, gaining or regaining control over Latin America, which they are quickly losing control of. So pretty interesting article. I think it's well worth a read. As I said, it's in Consortium News. January 31st, it was published by Vijay Prashad. So, any thoughts, guys?
Why do you say that the United States is rapidly losing control of Latin America? I hope that's true, but the trend I see overall is the opposite.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think that's true. I mean, they've had some victories in this just in this last year. With Bolivia and with Ecuador, but at the same time, you know, they're losing ground in Chile, with the whole, you know, Chilean government being run out of town with massive demonstrations. They're losing ground Argentina, with a new left-leaning government being elected in Argentina. They're definitely losing in their war against the people of Venezuela. The people of Venezuela are winning. They're losing in their war against the people of Nicaragua. The people of Nicaragua are winning. No, I think we've had, you know, if you just did a tally card and looked pluses and minus for our side and for their side, our side has had a lot more victories than their side over the last couple of years. You know, their side over the last 2-3 years has had victories in Brazil, of course, and in Bolivia now, and to a lesser extent in Ecuador. But at the same time, you know, millions of people rose up in Ecuador over the last couple of months protesting the neoliberal, the increasingly neoliberal phony socialist party of Lenin Moreno. Lenin Moreno ran as a socialist, but he's obviously a Bernie Sanders type who turned on the people once he got in. And that's why his government, you know, it really is in serious trouble right now, facing massive demonstrations that are demanding that he resign. So, you know, we'll see in the long run where that goes, but I think the people will win in that one. So, no, I would say definitely the tally card shows that we're winning. You know, our enemy, the capitalist ruling class, are fighting tooth and nail against us. That's why they're trying to spread this chaos, because chaos is opportunity for them. It gives them a way to, you know, to take control. So we'll see. I don't know if that, you know, if I've convinced you at all there,
you have.
Rainer.
Yeah, you have.
Okay. Bob, any thoughts?
Yeah, this was a very good article. It's a very good staggering statistics about wealth inequality.
Yeah.
Over 2,000 billionaires have more wealth than 4.6 billion people. It's just anemic global growth, not a care in the world about climate change, and you know, things as usual under business as usual under capitalism.
Absolutely, Bob. Absolutely. In any case, I think that's the end of our show tonight. Thank you, guys. We went an hour and a half. We still got a couple of minutes remaining in this hour and a half. So, Bob, maybe you could tell us about where we could go for more info.
Yeah, it was a fun show. Please go to our website, electionboycott.weebly.com, electionboycott.weebly.com, and make sure to friend us on Facebook. Just go to Election Boy or Facebook and type in Election Boycott Advocates on Facebook.
Great. Yeah, I agree with you, Bob. I had a lot of fun tonight. I think we covered some good stuff. You know, there was no big earth-shattering news over the last week or so, but a lot of important stuff for us to consider there. Rainer, as always, great contributions. Thank you so much. And guys, I guess we'll be talking again, same time, same place, next week.
Yeah.
So long till then.
Good night.
Good night.